So let's continue what we started yesterday. And so let me summarize a little bit. And today, during half of the lecture, I would like to conclude the analysis that we did, concluding with these R matrices, S matrices, and so on, and then spend the remaining half of the lecture with something new. So let me remind you that we encountered more or less the same object, this very important object, which is the transfer matrix T of U. And we encountered it both when constructing local Hamiltonians, namely, we multiply together many R matrices R, where R has two important properties. It obeyed Young-Baxter, so it obeyed this triangular relation. This was crucial because it ensured that this transfer matrix commutes for different value of the spectral parameter. And that gave rise to integrability in the end of the day because it gave rise to the existence of many conserved charges. The fact that R of 0 was equal to the permutation meant that log derivatives, derivatives of log of the transfer matrix, gave rise to local Hamiltonians. So it was a way of generating Hamiltonians with local interactions that were guaranteed to be exactly solvable. So what did we do? We diagonalized this object. And what do we do with the eigenvalue? We take log derivatives of the eigenvalue to compute the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. Then we solved a very similar problem. We diagonalized roughly the same object, but instead at the intersection, now we have an object which is the S matrix, not the R matrix. But what's the big difference? It also obeys Young-Baxter. It's in fact proportional to R, so it's basically technically, mathematically the same as R. It also obeys that S of 0 is the permutation operator, up to some simple proportionality factor. But the difference is that here we use the fact that S of 0 is the permutation to note that when I evaluate that transfer matrix at a value of the physical particles, I replace here the S matrix by the permutation. And therefore what happened was that the auxiliary particle became a physical particle. It swapped with the physical particle. And now I'm describing a physical particle that scatters with everyone else and comes back to the same position. So what do I do now once I have the eigenvalue of T? Instead of taking log derivatives, I do something totally different. I evaluate the eigenvalue at theta j, multiply by the free propagation of the particle, and impose that that's equal to 1. Okay, so it was two different uses of the same mathematical structure. So the key difference was S matrix versus R matrix, but that's trivial. That's just a proportionality factor. That's not a big deal. And technically, a slightly more important difference was here we had 0 everywhere. We had no impurities. We had an homogeneous spin chain. And here we have what we call a spin chain with impurities or with inhomogeneities because each side of the spin chain, now it's not quiet, but it's also moving a little bit because there are also the momenta of the spinons. The equations we got for the momenta of the spinons are written here. If you ignore the blue part, if you remove the blue part, remove this factor of 2, remove the blue products, and then the equations were the equations we wrote before. Then we said, well, but then this S matrix is very powerful. If I have this S matrix, if I manage to bootstrap and to fix completely this S matrix, I mean, I just start constructing this object, imposing these equations, and I find the spectrum of my theory. So why don't I forget about Hamiltonian and all that and try to directly bootstrap the S matrix? And that's what we did yesterday, and you continued in the tutorial. We said, let's suppose I want to find the S matrix of the O(n) sigma model, which is a strongly coupled, very interesting field theory. It's a very non-trivial field theory. Remember, this mass, for example, here was a non-perturbatively generated. Right? So it has a very an exponentially small mass that was non-perturbatively generated. And how do we find the S matrix of the O(n) sigma model? When, well, we write the three tensor structures that we could write. That just means that we know how to put indices. And then the relative coefficient of these tensor structures is totally fixed once I impose Young-Baxter. That's what you did yesterday in the tutorial. And then I get some functional equations for the prefactor. And as you know, when you have this kind of functional relations, then we are going to use things like gamma of x plus 1 equal x gamma of x. This is, if you want, is the fundamental identity. And we'll get a bunch of functional relations that will involve precisely shifts, because these shifts will have the meaning of shifting the rapidity by I pi, which means flipping particles to antiparticles. So we'll have a bunch of functional relations related to shifts. We use this kind of fundamental identities of gamma functions. And we get a bunch of gamma functions times something that's totally fixed. Okay? Now, the advantage of this is that it's highly powerful. I mean, no Lagrangian, nothing. It's just out of the blue, we get the result. The disadvantage is that if we don't have a Lagrangian, how do we know what we solved? How do we know that we solved the theory we wanted to solve and not something else? Right? So then we need to do checks. We need to do checks. For example, here we have n. And remember, when n was large, the theory became a bunch of free massive particles. So we can do an expansion at large n and compute many terms of that expansion, and then compare with the 1 over n expansion of this expression. Right? And people did it up to order 1 over n to the 6 or something like that, and they checked that all terms agreed. So probably it's the right solution. Okay? But I could also say, who cares? I want a theory which is integrable, which has O(n) symmetry, which has particles which are relativistic, then this is the solution. If it's not the Lagrangian I wrote before, I don't care about the Lagrangian, I care about the theory. Because I defined the theory through physical observables, and the S matrix is better than the Lagrangian. Okay? Now, when n is equal to 4, because SO4 is equal to SU2 times SU2, we get something simpler. In fact, these 8 gamma functions become just a square of 4 gamma functions, where here sits the same expression that we get before for the spin and S matrix as function of the difference of rapidities of the two particles. And the matrix part, where now the indices run from 1 to 4, each index, I can think of them as a product of two spinners. That's the usual transformation from O4 to SU2 times SU2. And then you can see that this tensor, in that case, factorizes and can be written as a product of just identity and permutation. Okay, just put here n equals to 4 and check that this is a true identity. Okay, and each of these guys obeys Young-Baxter, so this object obeys Young-Baxter. Now imagine I want to find the spectrum of what is the O(n) model on a big circle. What do? I take this S matrix, I construct this transfer matrix, and I diagonalize it and impose this. Now, because I have two R matrices, the problem factorizes, and I get, if you want, a transfer matrix for the right, a transfer matrix for the left, right? And what I would have to solve then, I would write the transfer matrix for the right, a transfer matrix for the left. I would put, say, one of these factors here, one of these factors there. And then the equation that I would get in the O4 model would be something like T right of theta j times T left of theta j times e to the I p of theta j times L equal to 1. And because I diagonalize the right and because I diagonalize the left, I introduce a set of auxiliary variables u to diagonalize the right and a set of auxiliary variables v to diagonalize the left. And therefore, we get the equations that I wrote here, where I have an extra equation for the v's, which is the same as the equation for the u's, and now the theta's coupled to the u's and to the v's. Again, the physical meaning is the same. Now we say that we start with a vacuum first. This is the vacuum of the O4 sigma model. Then we put some excitations. And what are these excitations? These excitations are a bunch of spins pointing both up. Okay? And then we flip some of them. For example, we can flip this one. But we can also flip the right one. So here we flip a left one, here we flip a right one. And then this left and right spin flips, they move in the spin chain. So we have two types of spin waves now, the left spin wave, the right spin wave, and the momentum wave of the physical particle. And now we have three equations coupling the left waves, the right waves, and the momentum waves. Okay? And that's the solution of the four mod. Okay? Now, I would like to point out something which I find very cute, which is the following. You might ask whether one can find this model of the O4 model. Can we get to these equations of the O4 starting from a spin chain? We did it for the spinons, and now we could ask, is there a spin chain that gives me not this spinon, but this O4 sigma model with relativistic particles, with this factor of 2, and so on. Okay? So that's the question. Okay? And the answer is, of course, yes. Okay? And I would like to briefly explain that. Any question here? Okay. So, what are our goals? Our goals are a relativistic dispersion relation, which means, for example, that the energy should be proportional to cos theta and not 1 over cos theta, like we were getting yesterday, or a few days ago, for the spinons. Right? So we want to transform 1 over cos theta, that was what we were getting for the spinons, into cos theta. And we want to get this factor of 2 that we have there for the S matrix. Or the S matrix of the excitations of the O4. So let me tell you how to do it. So first, there's something nice that we can do here. So what do we have here? Here, 1 over cosh, we have this function here, right? And what we want versus what we want, which is cosh, which is this instead. Right? So it doesn't look promising. But then we realize that cosh, you see, it looks like this, right? So it looks more like that. So perhaps there is a trick that we can double this bump, right? Double this bump, center it around minus something and plus something, and then send this something to infinity and get the beautiful cosh. So that's based on the following identity, indeed. That if I take 1 over cosh of theta plus a plus 1 over cosh of theta minus a and send a to infinity, this becomes e to the minus a, and then from here I keep one exponential, from here I keep another exponential, so it gives 2 e to the minus a times cosh of theta. Okay, so it's a trick that you start with two functions that vanish at infinity, and you get a function that explodes at infinity. Yeah? Because, of course, this is valid in this interval, but we are sending the interval to infinity, so now it's valid everywhere. Okay? So good. So this seems to hint, okay? So this hints, or not hints, it's really what it is suggesting that we do, at replacing in this spin chain, considering a different spin chain, where instead of having zero everywhere, what I'm going to do, I'm going to put A minus A, 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 A minus A. Then, what happens when I do this, is that when I do this, it indeed produces the shift we want. It's not the full modification I want to do, but it's a hint that this is what we should do. This will change putting A and minus A. It will change this U plus I over 2 over U minus I over 2 to the L. It would become now U plus A plus I over 2 over U plus A minus I over 2 to the power L over 2 times the same thing with minus A. And this kind of shift, if this factor was giving 1 over cos, now it gives 1 over cos shifted. If this guy was giving 1 over cos, it gives 1 over cos shifted. And therefore, we get this. And because we put L over 2, we even cancel this factor of 2. But okay, that's at the level of rigor I'm doing, that's a bonus. We don't care. Okay? Good. So doing something like this, taking a limit where we take this, and then go to the antiferromagnetic vacuum, and then study the effective excitations, it seems like just by doing this, we would get relativistic particles. This would be the energy. And the energy is the derivative with respect to theta of the momenta, and therefore the momenta would give something like sinh theta. Okay? Where this now would be interpreted as the mass, this exponentially small mass that we add when we dynamically generate through quantum effects. Okay? So indeed, that's a trick, a nice trick, to get a relativistic excitation out of the vacuum. Okay? That works. Okay? However, it doesn't give us the tool. The tool is not yet good. If I were to do this, this S matrix, right, it would be obtained by, remind you, that the kernel of the S of our S matrix would be given by the kernel divided by 1 plus the kernel. And the kernel did not change because I did not touch the S matrix. So I would get the same S matrix as before, therefore no factor of 2. Because the vacuum is still the antiferromagnetic vacuum. The kernel is just the kernel of the magnons. And I would get the same without a factor of 2. Okay? So what we want, right? So the kernel, let me know, the effective kernel that we get would be this. But the kernel that we want, the kernel for the O4 that we want, is twice that. This is what we would get. This was the old. And this is what we want. Right? Do you agree? So we must find a theory where this combination is this k tilde over 1 plus k tilde. So it must be a theory where the vacuum corresponds to some S matrix, where once I construct this combination, I get twice this combination that I know what I should get. Okay? Because this was, whenever I have a theory, I do this procedure, I get some effective excitations. Okay? So this, what we want to get is e to the minus absolute value of omega over 2 divided by cosh of omega over 2. If you remember, when we did the exercise the other day, I added 2 downstairs, 2 cosh. And I removed the 2 because of this 2 here. So this is what we want. And we ask what k gives that. And that tells me what's k tilde of omega. Okay? It's the k tilde of omega, which gives this expression here, which is, if I compute this expression, it gives me cotangent of omega over 2 minus 1. If k tilde is equal to this, then it generates this, which is exactly what I need. Okay? So I would like a theory where my S matrix has this Fourier transform rather than the previous one, which was e to the minus absolute value of omega. Right? This was what corresponded, I remind you, to u minus v plus I over u minus v minus I. The S matrix of the magnets was Lorentzian of size 1, so it gave e to the minus omega. I take this e to the minus omega, I construct this combination, and this combination gives me e to the minus omega over 2 times 2 cosh omega over 2. Okay? So this was the kernel we had before. We construct this combination and we got this. Instead, I want this, so I need this kernel as my starting point rather than this kernel as my starting point. Okay? Now, we can go and try to see if we find this kernel, cotangent of omega over 2 minus 1. Let's try to find it. So what kernels do we know? These are the ones we know. We compute the kernel between a scattering of two strings, one string of size n, one string of size m. I computed in the lecture those three cases there. The general expression is this. So what limit could we do on that expression to get cotangent of omega over 2 minus 1? Can someone tell me what limit could you imagine that would give me this? So you see that the minus 1 could be the minus Kronecker delta. The cotangent is already there. And I want to get that parenthesis there to be 1. So one thing I can do, I can set n equal to m, and then both very large to kill the second exponential. Okay? So what we could do is scatter k of a big string of size 2s of omega. When s goes to infinity, it goes exactly to the k tilde we want. Good. So what does it mean? It means that what I want is a theory whose vacuum corresponds not of real solutions, but of a bunch of strings of size 2s. I want to have a theory whose vacuum is a bunch of strings of size 2s, such that when I go to the continuum limit, that's the kernel I need to invert, and not the kernel for real solutions. Right? So it seems like we want a theory where the vacuum is equal to a bunch. This is going to be hard to draw. I think I'll do the following. I'll draw this. A bunch of rectangles where the vacuum is a bunch of strings of size 2s. Where s is sent to infinity, and where, yeah, that's it. Okay. And the answer is that the way we do it, and this is achieved by considering the antiferromagnetic limit, antiferro, of a spin chain of spin S rather than spin 1/2. So we consider a spin chain of spin S, which means that I have a spin chain, and at each side of the spin chain, I can have J running from minus 2S minus 1 up to 2S plus 1. Did I write it correctly? Probably not. No. From minus S up to S. So there are 2S plus 1 possibilities. Okay? The ferromagnetic vacuum, the ferromagnetic vacuum would be a spin chain where I have minus S at each side of my spin chain. And then putting excitations, a magnon, an excitation that moves on the spin chain here, would correspond to acting with the creation operator at position N on this spin chain. So it means that in position N, I will flip minus S to minus S plus 1. And then this excitation moves where it acts. And then this excitation would move here. And then I could put another sigma M plus, and this would be another magnet that would move and so on. And what would be the antiferromagnetic vacuum? The vacuum where the spins want to be anti-aligned. Morally speaking, the antiferro would be, roughly speaking, because it's not even correct for spin 1/2, but it's roughly minus S plus S minus S plus S, ta 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 ta. Right? Which means that you see that a difference here is that now sigma n plus square is not equal to zero. Because I can add twice and increase the spin twice if the spin is big. I can even increase it 3 times, 4 times, and n times, many times until I get zero. What it means in terms of these excitations is that they are not hardcore bosons. They can now stay on top of each other. It's not like they just eat each other and bounce. Now they can pass by each other and sit on top of each other. So you see that now what we want to do it is form, is think of this guy, what I have here, is like a string, because I want to have a bound state where almost all sigma n plus are here, such that here I generate a big spin. And then I have another string here, such that I put all creation operators more or less in the same position to generate another big spin. And therefore, this intuition tells me that if I go to the antiferromagnetic state of this spin S spin chain, I should get as vacuum a bunch of strings of size S. Okay? Now, then you can ask, what is the Hamiltonian for a spin chain of spin S? And you could ask, is it equal to lambda times some spin at position n dot spin at position n plus 1, where spin now is the spin S generator? Okay? And the answer is no. This Hamiltonian here would be not integrable. Okay? So what I have to do instead is find an R matrix, now for a different representation, compute it carefully, and find what Hamiltonian I get. For example, the Hamiltonian that we get for spin 1 is equal to lambda times sum of Sn dot Sn plus 1 square minus Sn dot Sn plus 1. With a precise coefficient behind the two terms, that makes sure the Hamiltonian is integrable. So if I were to construct the R matrix, where now it's not acting on a space C2, but on a bigger space where I have a representation of SU2, carry out that machinery and find the Hamiltonian, I would get this, with this precise coefficient between the two terms, where now the spins are three-component vector, act on three components rather than two components, are not the Pauli matrices. And more generally, we can construct the Hamiltonian of spin S. It's a complicated object. If you want, I can write it. But the punchline is that the only thing that happens is that it changes this I over 2, which is the spin, to IS over 2. At the end of the day, changing the spin, you read off here. Okay? So in the end of the day, we go now to spin S. All we do, therefore, is we also put an S here, S. And now, I have this factor here. And my final equations are this factor times product over J not equal to K of this factor with U replaced by UJ, UJ minus UK plus minus I, UJ minus UK plus I, equal to 1. This is the model we are going to try to start. So we start with this model. And now the claim is that this model, the vacuum, is indeed a bunch of strings of size 2s. So that's the vacuum. It's strings 2s. And there is some density associated to those strings of size 2s with center of mass theta. Associated to this vacuum, we have the kernel between 2s and 2s of omega, which is k tilde, such that k tilde over 1 plus k tilde is equal to twice what it was before, twice k over 1 plus k. In other words, is exactly the k that we want to get for the 4 sigma model. And as for the dispersion, the energy of theta becomes, and the momentum of theta, they become e to the minus a cos theta sinh theta. And then we are more or less done. What we say is that the theta j are the holes that we did not put, the strings that we did not put. So these holes, so this would be the holes in our rapidities u j of size, center of mass of size 2s. Okay? And then, in the same way that before the strings were restoring the symmetry, now the neighboring strings, the uj of size 2s plus 1 and the uj of size 2s minus 1, where you see that if I change the index by 1, the way they interact with the spin is the same because what appears there is the absolute value. So if I identify this as the uj and this as the Vj, then the thetas, the u's, and the v's, they obey the equations that I wrote there. Okay. So it's a cute implementation of a model which has asymptotic freedom, which is a strongly coupled sigma model, as the antiferromagnetic limit. This construction is due to Fadev and Reshetyakin. And someone that understood this cleanly and wrote it very cleanly was a former PI student, João Caetano. So you can also, if you want, if you are more curious about knowing more details, you can check this construction. Yes?
So when we promoted the spins to higher spins, we probably get, rather than SU2, something SUN or?
No, it's SU2, but higher representation of SU2. It's higher representation of SU2. So the space where it acts is also three-dimensional, like for SU3. But the symmetry that the object commutes with is SU2 symmetry. Okay. So the excitations, this is what I emphasized here. The only generators we have is sigma minus, sigma plus, and sigma z. We still only have these three generators. So putting an excitation means acting with a sigma n plus. But now when two excitations act on the same position, that just means that they are on top of each other. They create a bigger spin. But still, this is the only excitation we have. We don't have more generators. In SU3, we have more generators, so we have different types of excitations.
Is there a way to generate other ONN models?
So I should say something, which is that the answer is, I don't know. I think it's not known. And furthermore, there's something a little bit annoying that I did not tell you, which is, remember that when we start putting strings and holes and so on, we do this counting of states. We see how many holes do we have, how many possibilities, and we start counting the states. And you remember, for example, the spinons, we could only put an even number of spinons. So you could ask, okay, do I get the right equations? But do I get the correct Hilbert space? Do I get all the equations that I got there, where there I have no restriction and so on? And in fact, you get half of the Hilbert space. So even in the ON model, no one knows how to get the full Hilbert space. You only get half of the Hilbert space. So it's kind of an open problem to understand how to go beyond this. Okay? So let me just make one final comment, so, which is that the most general thing that we could imagine having here, our matrix and S matrix from a mathematical point of view is roughly the same, but you could imagine generalizing, right? And considering a different object, let me put these lines differently, where here I associate U, here I associate V, and I put different lines to say that this acts on some space V1, which I could say is some representation lambda, and this acts on some V2, which is the space where some other representation lambda tilde acts. Right? And then I could have these different representations. One of them could be spin S, the other could be fundamental. One of them could be a joint of SUN, the other could be fundamental of SUN. And then the equations we would have more generally are not equations acting on three equal spaces, but equations where the lines can be in different spaces. Like this. And if these objects obey the right algebra, then it would imply that when we construct transfer matrices in a given representation for a given spectral parameter U, they also commute if we change the representation and change the spectral parameter. Right? Where what do I mean by this T with the representation? I mean that I have some physical space. The physical space, for example, I don't touch, or I can touch if I want. But the auxiliary space, I say that I scatter a different type of particle on a different representation, and I trace it over it. So you see, a way of thinking about this transfer matrix is a bit like you have some state and you consider a scattering experiment where you send some auxiliary particle u that measures the state. And because you measure it at any momentum u, you are getting information about the state. But you could also send other types of particles, more complicated objects, bigger molecules, like some benzene, fluorides or whatever. You send some huge representation, like some big ball. And you measure, again, the charges of the state and so on. And all these objects would commute with each other. So, of course, mathematically, all this commuting stuff and all this moving the lines around and so on hint that perhaps there is a way of understanding the emergence of this mathematical structure from some kind of topological matter theory, where I would have some kind of topological theory where the fact that I can move the lines around is a reflex of the theory being topological, which topological theory means a theory where I can move lines around. And this is what happens in some mathematical theories of knots, when I have a bunch of knots and I'm just unknotting things and so on. But there, in those typical theories of knots, or Schoen-Simons theories, there's no spectral parameter. You just have knots, you don't have U and V. But one thing that Kevin understood last year, or 1.5 years ago or something, was how to introduce spectral parameter in those topological games. By thinking that these knots are live, there is some extra dimension that you don't see, and when you are knotting and unknotting, the knots, they look like they are touching, but in the extra dimension, they are separated by U, and U is going to become the spectral parameter. So I think that that's a little bit the point where Kevin will start. He will start by exploring the algebra of these RTT relations from a more mathematical point of view. For us, we just wrote the algebra and commuted A's through B's and so on, a la physicist. But he's going to explain what's really the mathematical underpinning structure there, and then try to approach all these mathematical relations from field theory, trying to explain what's the origin of the fact that these objects had to commute, they needed to commute in a constructive way that explains these properties that they obey. So if you remember, I had three questions that I wanted to solve in my lectures. And basically, we answered two of them. And the question that the one that we did not answer was related to the Lagrangian of Sine-Gordon theory. So I think because it's something simple I can explain in 15 minutes, I would like now to go to the last question that we had listed in the first lecture, okay? Which is something related to something we played with in this winter school. But any question here? What I'm going to do now is a bit disconnected from this part. Okay, so we see that in integrable theories, the scattering of three particles factorizes into a product of two body scattering events. And that we could understand. It was a consequence of saying that the sum over the initial states of some charges, for example, if the theory is relativistic, I would write e to the theta j times s times the mass of the particle, right? And energy and momentum correspond to s equal plus minus 1. But suppose we have some other charges, and we say that this charge is equal to the same thing for the final states, m e to the I theta j times s, where s is plus minus 1. That's the usual energy and momentum conservation. But suppose it's also plus minus 2 and so on. Now, this equation, it implies a couple of interesting things. If I have here n and m, it implies, first of all, that n needs to be equal to m. And second of all, that the set of final momenta is equal to the set of initial momenta. And therefore, the particles theta 1 goes to theta 1, theta 2 goes to theta 2, theta 3 goes to theta 3, as expected, because the scattering factorizes. And then needs to be equal to m, which means that in these theories, there is no particle production. Okay. So this matrix, the scattering process of two particles, going into four particles and so on is equal to zero. Okay. So the question is, we have seen some theories here which are strongly coupled and that don't have particle production. You see, they are strongly coupled. The S matrix there, let me emphasize, the S matrix there, it's just a function of theta. It has no lambda. There's no parameter that I can expand and see that the S matrix is 1 plus something small. No, it is just what it is. It's an order 1 big strongly coupled thing. Lambda doesn't appear, even though lambda appeared in the Lagrangian of the O-N model, lambda doesn't appear there at all. It disappeared completely. What appears instead is the mass m. So lambda, which was unphysical, disappeared and gave rise to m, which is physical. This phenomena is what's called dynamical mass transmutation. You transmute something ugly, which is lambda, into something beautiful, which is a mass, something physical. Okay? And only m appears there, and there's no weakly coupling. There's no lambda anymore that I can expand at weak coupling or something like that. But we could imagine theories. We could imagine checking, constructing perturbative integrable theories. We could ask, are there integrable theories that we can construct perturbatively? Okay, so let's try to construct a perturbative theory. Let's try to do it. So let's consider a single scalar. So let's write the Lagrangian to be 1/2. We have a single scalar plus we have a kinetic term plus we have, say, a cubic term. Now, scalar is dimension 0. So we put something like m squared over 3 factorial times lambda. Okay. This would be our starting point. It's a theory, it's perturbative, there is a lambda there, and so on. This would be, I will complete it soon, but this part would be what I would call my potential V of phi. If the theory is free, it is just m squared phi squared over 2, otherwise this is the potential. And then I would like to consider this theory. Okay? In perturbation theory. Now, this theory is not integrable. It's not integrable because I can produce particles. I can consider this Feynman diagram where I have cubic coupling, cubic coupling, cubic coupling. And this contributes and describes an S-matrix process where two particles go to three particles. You can have five particles in total here. Okay? So is it clear? Just to make clear what this diagram is, by this diagram, what do we mean? Let's write explicitly. We mean the following. We mean that we have some momenta, P1 up to P5, right? And we separate it into a partition. Two momenta go here, alpha. Two go here, beta, and here is gamma, such that alpha union gamma union beta is the set P1 up to P5. These are two momenta that obey total conservation. So the sum of this Pj mu equal to zero. So we sum over alpha, over this splitting of this momenta into partitions. Right? We have 1, 2, 3 couplings, so we get lambda cube. And we get a propagator, let me write G, which carries momentum alpha, and another propagator here, which carries momenta alpha plus gamma, which is the same as minus beta. Okay? And because this is the same diagram, if I swap alpha and beta, there is a factor of 1/2 here not to overcount. Okay? So that's what this diagram is. Is it clear? Right? Yeah? Okay. Now, so this diagram is non-zero. So we have this, and this is not zero. Okay. Then we can say, well, let me try to add m squared over 4 factorial times some lambda 4 times phi to the 4. I want to add an extra term. Okay, now we have an extra diagram in that case. Now I have this and this. I have these two diagrams. So it means that now I have plus a sum of splitting into alpha and beta, my momenta, lambda times lambda 4 times the propagator of alpha. Where now I sum and this would be alpha. Okay? And now something funny happens, which is an untrivial identity. Okay? This is okay. It's a mess in general. Yeah, it's what it is. But it's equal to minus 5 times lambda cube if this lambda 4 is equal to 3 times lambda squared. And what I want to emphasize by this is that this is a constant. It's very non-trivial that I'm adding these rational functions. I add this complicated thing. But on the support of momentum conservation, when I have that the sum up to 5 of my momenta, this here happens. It's just an identity of rational functions. You can just believe me that it's a mess. I'm sure you would agree. The fact that it's a constant when these parameters are tuned is what you might be a bit surprised. Okay, but it is the case. So it means that we have some hope. Let's try the following. Let's consider a theory where here I have 3 lambda. And where now I add plus m squared over 5 factorial times 5 lambda cube times phi to the 5. Now I canceled completely particle production because now I add a constant term, which is a contact interaction, that just cancels precisely particle production. So in doing this, now the S matrix 2 to 3 computed at 3 level is equal to 0. Okay. Okay. But now the problem is that 2 to 4 is not 0. Okay. So now the claim is that we can add some phi to the 6, phi to the 7, tac 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 tac, so that we cancel completely S2 to n for n bigger or equal than 3. We can complete it. Now, this claim that looks rather general, this is actually not the most interesting part of what I want to tell. Because the way it works is the following. Suppose I want to cancel 2 to 4. So when I want to study 2 to 4, what do I need to consider? I need to consider, say, this possibility. Say, 2 particles go to 4 particles. I need to consider this possibility. I need to consider this possibility. I need to consider this, which is the new term. And I need to consider this three-level diagram. And I need to consider this diagram. So these are all the diagrams I need to consider. And as I increase, consider more and more particles, I need to consider more and more diagrams. But when I have these many diagrams, what do I have? I have a rational function. And I want to ask, is this rational function a constant or not? Because if it's a constant, I can cancel it. And the point is that once you check, let me take some residue where 1 and 2 become on shell. I take a residue. If they add up to an on-shell propagator, this propagator explodes. So it means that I focus on the contribution where I replace these two lines and consider this leg to be on-shell. But then what happens is that you see that the residue that you get is 0 because of the case that you checked already. So by induction, you can show that if you cancel 2 to 3, what you can show is that we can cancel 2 to n. You don't show how you cancel, but you show that you can cancel. You show that at each order, the function is a constant. And because it's a constant, I can add the contact interaction, phi to the n plus 2, to cancel that constant. OK? So it proves that we can do it. So now let's do it then. So if we can, let's do it. OK? So now we fix the potential via phi. So how do we fix the potential via phi? We do the following trick. We say, let me consider my momentum, my rapidities, theta j of my particles, to be theta 1 for the first particle. Then for the second particle, I'll put theta equals 0. For the next one, I'll put it to be x. For the other one, 2x, 3x, tac, 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 up to n minus 3x. And then the last one, I leave it theta n plus 2. Sorry, theta n. This is, so n is the total number of particles here. So this is a process where I'm studying s, 2 goes to n minus 2. So n is the total number of particles. So what are we doing here? I'm considering this where I theta 2 up to theta n minus 1 I fix. And I'm going to send this x to infinity, which means that I'm going to consider particles that are very, very energetic. But this one is much more energetic than this, which is much more energetic than this, which is much more energetic than this, and so on. Okay? And these two I don't fix because energy and momentum conservation fixes two of them for me. And it fixes, and when we solve energy and momentum conservation, we get that theta n is equal to minus n minus 3 times x plus some small corrections. And theta 1 is small right away. So the picture that we have here is that in this limit, these two particles are the super energetic ones. And they are colliding head-on. They make an explosion. They explode, and they produce a particle whose energy is minus the energy of this guy, n minus 2x. And that collides with this guy and produces a particle with still lots of energy, but now this guy, and so on. So there is a cascade of scattering at super high energy and getting lower and lower and lower energy until you get to the very quiet guys. Okay, that's a physical picture of what's going on. And now, when you consider this, what happens is that if you consider a propagator, g of alpha, in this limit here, you can see that this propagator becomes equal to minus 1 over m squared, or 0, And it becomes minus 1 over m squared if alpha is 1 up to k, all ordered particles, and 0 otherwise. Because what happens is that the propagator is 1 over momentum squared plus m squared, or minus m squared, right? It's 1 over momentum squared minus m squared. So if the moment is very large, it goes to 0, the propagator. And typically, it goes to 0, because if I take a particle from here, a particle from here, the moment is huge. The only way it doesn't go to 0 is if I take them, these two guys, because they cancel each other, because they are facing head-on. And then, in fact, you can see that p squared in that case is going to 0 and not to infinity. And because it goes to 0, the propagator becomes minus 1 over m squared in that case. Okay? So the key is that in this case, the momenta of set alpha squared goes to 0, whereas here, the momenta of set alpha squared goes to infinity. Okay? So with this trick, this is a powerful trick because it means that in these diagrams, if I want to claim that they add up to a constant and I want to find which constant it is, I evaluate these diagrams in these kinematics. And what must happen is that these diagrams are zero unless when I cut, on one side I have the particles all ordered. For example, here I would need this. And here, because I can cut here, I need 1, 2. Because I can cut here, I need here 3. Right? So you see that all these diagrams, the particles need to be totally ordered, otherwise the propagator is 0. And this diagram here cannot contribute, because I cannot, if I cut it here, if I say that here I have 1, 2, okay, here I'm already done. Because now down, yeah, because here I could have 5, 6, and here I would have 3, 4. So now I have a problem here. Here I have 3, 4, I don't have neither the, right? So the moment here I get 0 for this propagator. So the only diagrams that contribute, when I take this limit, once we consider this limit, the only diagrams that contribute are the diagrams which are a line with a bunch of vertices in that line. Okay? Okay. So then, we can write the contribution of those diagrams. We say, consider the case where I have all the vertices, the contact interaction, right? So, if I write my potential V of phi as m squared sum of lambda to the n, cn over n factorial, phi to the n, such that, right? If I write like this, this term would give me, this diagram would give me Cn. Plus, I have the possibility where I have a cubic coupling here and n minus 1 vertices there. Plus, Cn minus 1 times the cubic vertex C3, C3 is just lambda. This is C3. And the powers and the propagator here is minus 1. It's minus 1 over m squared, but the powers of m squared cancel because there are two vertices here, one vertex here, so I don't need the 1 over m squared. Okay? There is another possibility then, which is when I consider here two less vertices, so plus, and I have now two less vertices, Cn minus 2. And now I have two possibilities. I have two cubic couplings, so I would have lambda square, and now there is one propagator that gives minus 1, another that gives minus 1, so there is no minus sign. Or I could have the same thing with a quartic vertex, and in this case I would get minus, because there is a propagator, 3 times lambda square, because this is minus lambda 4. And lambda 4 was 3 times C squared, remember? There. And the point is that now you can stop here. You don't need nothing else. Because the rest is zero by induction. Meaning that if I consider here very few vertices, I have many legs on this side, but these many legs, I already showed it's zero. It's only when I have very few legs here that I need to write the equation. When I already have many terms here, I already showed that they add up to zero, like there. So here is a recursion relation. Here is a recursion relation that we can now solve, right? Cn, Cn minus 1, Cn minus 2, we just solve it, okay? If we solve it, we then find that V of phi is equal to m square over 6 lambda square e to the 2 lambda phi plus 2 e to the minus lambda phi minus 3. We compute the C's and we get this potential. So this, you see, it's a beautiful potential. This is a perturbative integrable theory. It's a theory which doesn't produce particles. Now, you could have imagined a different case, a case where there is no cubic coupling. You could imagine the case where you start where this C3 is equal to zero, where there's no cubic coupling. Then this term here would be zero. And here we would say that this would be minus lambda. We would call this minus lambda, which is the quartic coupling. Okay? So now, if you have a theory which has Z2 symmetry, where you don't have a cubic coupling, you would have to, the starting identity, instead of that one, would be the statement that when I just have quartic coupling, that this is actually a constant, which is the case. If I sum over permutations alpha, this is indeed a constant. But then if this is a constant, everything I said so far goes true. And what equation do I get? I get an equation that tells me, in that case, that Cn is equal to Cn minus 2 up to a sine. But what is the function whose Taylor expansion alternates between minus 1 and 1 up to 1 over n factorial? Well, but then the potential V of phi is m square over lambda square cosine of lambda phi minus 1, which was exactly the Sine-Gordon model that we saw in the first lecture. Right? The theory whose terms alternate. Okay? So this is how we could have guessed that this theory was special by showing that it's a theory where perturbatively, if we impose Z2 symmetry and no particle production, it's the only perturbative integrable theory of a single scalar. And we could now imagine playing these games that I showed you here when you generalize this to many scalars and more complicated potentials. That's exactly what some of us here are doing. Thank you. I'll stop here.
T-shirt.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.